I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. The unrest following the death of Freddie Gray made Baltimore ground zero for protests against police brutality and a national Exhibit A for the stark disparity in economic conditions between black and white citizens. Maryland is the wealthiest state in the country, yet median household income for a black Baltimorean is $33,000 a year. Baltimore's unemployment rate remains 3 points higher than Maryland. The loss of thousands of manufacturing jobs over the last 5 decades is often cited as a major factor in these persistent conditions. Is American manufacturing in terminal decline, or will we see a comeback? Is the reshoring of manufacturing a myth? Could Under Armour make a profit making products in Baltimore? Please join us for Midday after the news. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Midday. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us. Today, we take a deep dive into some questions about American manufacturing, one of the factors often cited for Baltimore's persistently high level of unemployment and poverty is the loss, traceable back some 50 years, of thousands of manufacturing jobs, particularly those that paid wages that paved the way to a middle-class life for workers. There have been so many changes in the regional economy over the years with an increasingly educated workforce in such fields as cybersecurity, life sciences, and IT, that manufacturing seems like an antiquated concept, something nostalgic. But we thought we'd take a look to see what's there. We've been planning this discussion for several weeks, with the unrest following the death of Freddie Gray still fresh, drawing attention as it did not only to tensions between police and black citizens, but to stark economic disparities in conditions for people in inner-city Baltimore, so the subject is particularly timely. Both hours of Midday today are devoted to the manufacturing question. Before we get to that, here's a quick update related to the death of Freddie Gray. On Saturday, the superstar Prince released a song called Baltimore that many have been calling an upbeat protest song about the death of Freddie Gray and police brutality. Last night, Prince performed at the Royal Farms Arena in downtown Baltimore, calling the concert a rally for peace. Thousands were in attendance, despite the late announcement for the show. Tickets ranged in price from $22 to $497. And although his specific dollar amount or percentage has not been disclosed, Prince did say that a portion of the proceeds from the rally for peace will go to Baltimore-based youth charities. On Sunday, the Baltimore Sun reported that Freddie Gray was among many who did not receive medical attention after being arrested by Baltimore police. From June 2012 to April 2015, 2,600 detainees with a wide variety of injuries, including fractured bones and hypertension, were denied medical treatment while in custody. That's according to the Sun. Criminologists say that incidents such as these show that Baltimore City police officers are not receiving adequate training to detect and respond to injuries. Defense motions. On Friday, lawyers for the 6 officers charged in Freddie Gray's death filed motions asking for dismissal of the charges, claiming the city's top prosecutor, State's Attorney Marilyn Mosby, has so many conflicts of interest that she should have recused herself from the case. J. Amy Dillard, professor of law at the University of Baltimore, who's been joining us here on Midday to talk about the various steps in the legal process here and various aspects of the Freddie Gray case, joins us again. Hello, Amy.
How are you?
Good. The motions that were filed by the lawyers for the 6 defendants on Friday. Rarely in the history of any criminal case has a prosecutor so directly maintained so many conflicts of interest, and a prosecutor steadfastly refused to recuse him or herself. That's a quote from the 23-page filing in the district court. These charges, the attorneys say, represent extraordinary prosecutorial overreaching. And at worst, the charges are, quote, something far more nefarious. This is the kind of rhetoric we're used to seeing in motions for dismissal in criminal cases?
No, not that often, though I will say that defense attorneys often think that prosecutors overreach in how they charge crimes. And while we might ask for a dismissal based on that sort of overreaching, the general answer is you take that to a jury, and the jury will decide whether or not the prosecutor has been overreaching in the charges or not. I think these have been filed, obviously, because these are police officers and the publicity around this case. And you know, the allegation of overreaching is pretty standard, a pretty standard feeling that defense attorneys have when they represent criminal defendants.
What about the accusation of conflicts of interest, multiple conflicts, and that Marilyn Mosby should have recused herself? That's unusual because of the political nature of the state's attorney's office, I guess, partly because this particular state's attorney is married to a city councilman and had professional relationship or political relationship with the lawyer for the Gray family, Billy Murphy.
Yeah, you know, I read the motion to dismiss, and I saw basically two big areas where they were complaining about her. The first is in the personal relationships that she has, obviously, with her husband, and in the past relationship that professional relationship that she has with Billy Murphy. But you know, the links there, they're obvious, meaning she has those relationships. But linking that to showing how that's motivated her in this case, I thought was a little tenuous. The second complaint, you know, really is that she's violated the Maryland rules of professional conduct. I think primarily in the press conference that she gave when she decided to bring the charges, that you know, the things that she said have violated the rule on trial publicity and the rules that apply, the special rules that apply to prosecutors, to make sure that they don't say things that might taint the trial when it comes along.
Another thing the lawyers say, they're challenging the accusation that the officers illegally arrested Freddie Gray. And Marilyn Mosby has said this arrest was illegal, and one of the officers, I think, is charged with false imprisonment.
Yeah, best I can see. The allegation, and I think this goes back to the statement that she made. You know, in her press conference, she made a statement that the arrest was illegal and that the knife was lawful under Maryland law. That sort of commentary on the evidence has been roundly criticized by the Maryland Court of Appeals in the, you know, infamous Doug Gansler case from 2003. But to the heart and the substance of that, it seems that you know, she maintains that the law that the knife that Freddie Gray had did not violate the Maryland code. Defense counsel for the police officers maintained that even if it didn't violate the Maryland code, it may have violated the Baltimore ordinance, and that it would be reasonable for the officers to be mistaken, even if it wasn't illegal to carry that knife.
Amy, thanks very much today. We'll have more from J. Amy Dillard as this case moves along. Thank you very much for joining us again.
You're welcome. Bye.
J. Amy Dillard is Associate Professor of Law at the University of Baltimore. She's an expert in criminal defense. She also sat on the independent review panel for the Baltimore City Police Department that looked into the 2013 in-custody death of Tyrone West. That's why we've had her on the show. She joins us here from time to time. We'll take a short break here on Midday, and when we get back, last year the U.S. created more domestic manufacturing jobs than it lost to other countries. Nike says it will add 10,000 manufacturing jobs in the U.S. if the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement is approved. Could Under Armour do the same? Our look at the future of manufacturing in the U.S. and in the Baltimore region starts right after these messages from WYPR. Welcome back. Dan Rodericks here. Today on Midday, we're devoting both hours of the show to manufacturing in the U.S. and in Maryland. In the second hour, we'll speak with two successful manufacturers, both in Baltimore, Drew Greenblatt of Marlin Steel and John Danko of Danko Arlington. We'll talk to them about the potential return of manufacturing and how that could help reduce unemployment, specifically in Baltimore City. Also joining us in the second hour will be Jermaine Jones, the business manager for Local 710, the Construction Workers Labor Union. In 2014, just last year, the U.S. saw a net gain of 10,000 manufacturing jobs. That's news. That's the first time in 20 years that the U.S. has created more manufacturing jobs than it lost. So what's going on there? How much of a factor will manufacturing be in the future economy? Is reshoring, the reshoring of jobs, a trend that we'll see continue? And if so, will robotics undercut any anticipated gains in jobs? Some of the questions we'll wrestle with in this hour. Joining me now in Studio A, Darius Irani, Chief Economist of the Regional Economic and Studies Institute based at Towson University, where he is Associate Vice President of the Division of Innovation and Applied Research. Darius, nice to have you back on the show.
Thank you very much, Dan.
And a colleague from Towson University with
yes.
you today, Stephen Phillips, history professor at Towson and an expert in Chinese history, culture, and economy. Thanks for joining us, Steve. Nice to have you with us.
Thank you very much.
And joining us from New York, Nelson Schwartz, economics reporter for the business section of the New York Times. Nelson, thank you for joining us.
Great to be here.
Well, since I started with that word reshoring, I guess people know what that means. It means companies that were overseas, manufacturing companies, actually coming back to the United States versus, say, a company starting up for the first time, a foreign company starting up for the first time in the U.S. So let's talk about reshoring. I'll start with Nelson on this because I think it was 3 or 4 years ago, a cover story in Atlantic Magazine made a big deal about how manufacturers were coming back to the United States. How do you see it from where you are?
There is some reshoring going on. I feel like we journalists maybe make too big a deal of it in terms of the numbers overall. Going back to the statistics you just cited, I mean, it's great when it happens. It's, you know, manufacturing is vital for the American economy, but it, you know, the anecdotal examples are striking, but don't necessarily change the overall picture. And I mean, part of the reason the reshoring or onshoring is coming back is because, you know, the labor prices in China are going up, so there's less of an advantage that the Chinese have there. Transportation costs with oil until very recently being expensive, and it sort of costs more to ship. And finally, manufacturers want to be closer to their customers, so there's less, you know, lead time in ordering new products. So all that does help reshoring. The problem is, you know, America is making as much or more value-wise as it ever did. Even in the, you know, I used to work as a reporter researcher at the Sun. You know, like in Dundalk and all those mills and steel mills. I mean, they're closed, but we're still making as much steel as we did in the past. It's just we're doing it with a fraction of the workers. So that's the big challenge. I mean, you might get some reshoring, but it's not going to bring back, you know, factories where the whistle blew and thousands of people walked out of the yard.
Steve Phillips, how do you see it?
I think the wage differential between the United States and China is so great, roughly $4,000 a month. In the United States, 600 something a month in China, that even doubling China's wages may not have a huge impact. The real issue in the long run might be whether or not China becomes the richest of the poor countries and starts losing a lot of its jobs to other countries. But a lot of those jobs making shoes and sandals and T-shirts are probably never going to come back to the United States.
Darius, how do you see it? Do we see any reshoring in Maryland? Is there any evidence of that here?
I haven't seen much of it. I mean, it comes and go. I mean, and to Nelson's point, I mean, we have seen a dramatic decrease in employment in that time period from 1990 to 2014. But to that point, we've also seen a dramatic increase in real dollars in the value of goods and services, the value of manufactured goods, about a 50% increase. So we're producing more with less. And part of it is,
where are we? What are the numbers on workers in the manufacturing?
About, in 1990, we had about 119,000, and then now we're down to about 198,000 in 1990, and we're down to about 103,000 in most recent numbers as a report.
Well, so that's about half where we were 25 years ago.
Yeah, it's a dramatic drop, but we've also had about a 50% increase in value of manufactured goods produced. And at the same time period, the U.S. saw a similar drop in manufacturing employment, you know, and a little bit not as dramatic increase in the value of real goods produced. But nevertheless, that seems to be the trend. It's much more of less of a labor intensive and much more capital intensive. And the real thing is what's happened in China is since labor is cheap, labor intensive products tend to migrate towards, you know, where labor is fairly inexpensive. And as pointed out, it's slowly migrating to other cheaper places, Vietnam, Thailand, you know, Bangkok, you know, is moving slowly to the lowest point of cheap labor, where it's much more labor intensive. Where it's capital intensive, what we're seeing is, again, much more declines in number of employees And again, but the value of goods is still going up. And that's what we've all been saying. The productivity of our workers are much higher, about 10-15% since even 2006 in manufacturing. So it is a rather, you know, it's a sea change. So when you talk about the antiquated notion of manufacturing, we need to sort of disavow ourselves of that statement, because manufacturing today looks so much different. In terms of much more computers, much more robotics, and people in white lab coats, you know, young people operating computers, you know, whereas there used to be hundreds of people, there might be tens of people now.
Well, I wanted to talk about that for a minute. Why this is important? Why is manufacturing important for different people? They have different reasons for why they would value it. It might be an aesthetic thing. You know, you would like to know that people in the United States make stuff, right? That it isn't all a bunch of paperwork or things that we do on computers or research or IT or cybersecurity, that there's actually things you can hold in your hand. So yeah. For some people, it's that.
What about the
wages, though? What about quality of life in terms of workers?
I would also add, for military purposes, constant concern over too many, everything from computer chips to parts of airplanes being produced overseas.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it isn't just whether it makes us feel good or how much money. People in Washington worry about being dependent on other countries
to manufacture what we need for the military
or for parts that will go into those things.
Yeah.
Can I add just a sure. slightly more even depressing note about reshoring? I'm sorry, but there is some, you know, anecdotally reshoring going on, and it's going to Virginia and to the South.
Mm-hmm.
When manufacturing is coming back, it tends to go to the same place the manufacturing jobs have gone within the United States, non-union states.
Okay,
so that
gets me to my question, and why is this important to talk about manufacturing? Nelson, I'll go to you. Unless there's unions in place, as there were when we had lots of steel mills in the United States or automobile assembly plants, doesn't necessarily mean that this will enhance the quality of life, get people to the middle class.
Generally, manufacturing jobs, even in non-union states like South Carolina, which I wrote about, they do tend to pay more than jobs that would go to high school graduates or people with some college, you know, an associate's degree. So manufacturing jobs do pay more than, say, a Home Depot or a Walmart or a restaurant, something like that. So it's important for that reason. The other thing is, you know, economists speak of a multiplier effect. You know, how much impact on the broader economy does every dollar in wages, you know, or value in manufacturing? And, you know, I'm not an economist, but the economists will vouch for this, that the multiplier effect of manufacturing is greater than other sectors. So it has a bigger impact in the sense that the workers from the factory will go to the restaurant, will go to the retailer, will buy a home, we'll hire, you know, somebody to do work in their home, and all that kind of effect, the ripples come outward from manufacturing. That's very important. Plus, you know, you kind of develop an ecosystem where, let's say you have an auto manufacturer, you begin to develop parts suppliers and, you know, other subsidiary-type companies. And that's what's happened in South Carolina, a non-union state, for the most part. They drew BMW to the northwestern part of the state about 20 years ago. And the whole sort of industry has developed there, which has been very successful. And those are good jobs. Again, you know, I can't say this enough. Only about 1/3 of Americans have college degrees. We need to find opportunities for the other 2/3. And, you know, manufacturing does offer those opportunities. Although you need more training, you might need a certificate, you might need vocational training, you might need an associate's degree. But those are other reasons why manufacturing is important.
Before we leave the subject of reshoring, which is sort of the sexy part of manufacturing to talk about, the idea of a company actually leaving Asia or Latin America and coming back to the United States where they were originally, why would a company do that? Say, why would an American company with an interest in China move an operation back to, I don't know, Georgia or South Carolina?
Well, a lot of it has to do with...
Go ahead, Nelson, then I'll go to Steve. Go ahead, Nelson.
A lot of it has to do with being closer to your customers. I mean, that's a new paradigm for manufacturers around the world, in the sense of you can, you know, there's sort of they call it mass customization type thing. So, you know, generally goods from China will come by ship, so that'll take weeks or months. Whereas if it's in the United States, say, like you mentioned, Georgia, let's say, you know, you could just truck it overnight to Chicago. So, you know, that's a big issue. And again, The labor, America's never going to compete on cheaper labor than China, but the transportation's a big factor. Plus, there's a desire, sometimes national security, you want to keep that here. And finally, you have more control over your supply chain and products, if it's closer to home. So those are all advantages if you're an American manufacturer. One thing I would just add is that generally people think there's no manufacturing left in the United States because they see consumer goods. And, most of what you buy at Walmart is from overseas. On the other hand, we're still making a lot of goods for companies, for businesses.
Steve Phillips.
Yeah, I would offer a couple of non-economic reasons to move jobs back. And first is public relations. Walmart has tried really hard to emphasize they're an American company because they got hit so hard for having so many Chinese goods.
Mm-hmm.
The other aspect is simply a feeling among some companies, and we saw this with the Japanese, we've invested so much in China, we're too dependent on goodwill of the Chinese government. There were anti-Japanese riots in China in 2012. Japanese investment dipped, not because they couldn't make money, but they were calculating, have we put all our eggs in one basket? Do we need to diversify where we put our production? So I think those factors could be important.
And that was a concern. Well, actually, Nelson mentioned national security, too. Does China manufacture products that are used by our military? Nelson, do you know?
Yes. I mean, there are some things we won't permit, Chinese companies to, say, buy an American maker of. But generally, I mean, so much of electronics and technology and chips, I think it's inevitable, particularly on the electronics front, that stuff is coming out of China. I mean, look, anyone who uses an iPhone is using something made in China.
That's right.
It sort of goes down from there.
Darius Irani, I'll go to you to talk about Maryland a little bit. This is a small percentage of our economy, manufacturing.
Yeah, it's a fairly small percentage of our economy. And again, we struggle with, being a unionized state to some degree. But we're also, our land is very expensive. So, again, we have to figure out how we can do more with less. And I think, in some sense, we're trying to strike a good balance with that. I suspect that many manufacturers, one of the biggest complaints is not getting enough qualified workers. Again, there are some specialized training programs at some of the community colleges, certifications they need, but also, some drug testing and criminal background checks need to be sort of, conducted, which, in some parts of this great state of ours is rather challenging for some of the younger folks here. But we need to figure out how we can get those folks, involved. And as Nelson pointed out, we're not going to beat China on labor costs at all, no matter what, even if you account for transportation costs in there. It's going to have to be sort of a more high-value manufactured goods that we're producing here.
That calls for technical skills.
Oh, definitely.
This isn't for uneducated or unskilled labor.
No, this is definitely skilled labor. And again, it's not your grandpa putting your wheels on the Buick. It's actually, someone, thinking about a CNC computerized milling machine, tight tolerances. It's very difficult, and also be able to produce those things in mass numbers for aerospace, for other places. So there are some great opportunities there for manufacturing here in this state, but also across this great land of ours.
When we talk about robotics, this word comes up whenever you talk about manufacturing and the promise of manufacturing, or you just, I don't know, it's wishful thinking that there would be more of it in the United States because you think of high unemployment in Baltimore City, for instance. Let's get some more jobs back here. But they need skills, right? And then there's the question of robotics in manufacturing. I mean, there could be the promise of more jobs undercut by that. Nelson?
Well, I think long-term, robotics will accelerate or continue the trend we talked about in Maryland, making 50% more in value with half the workers. On the other hand, the key is the skills. I mean, there will always be people needed to operate the robots, operate the machines, work in the factories. Where we are falling behind is the skills situation, and there are a lot of manufacturing jobs going begging because it's in the middle skills area, which means I have a college degree, but I could not go in off the street and do those jobs. I don't have the technical skills. I may not even have the math skills, quite honestly, even though I took math 20 years ago. the thing is, we really need as a country to update file on what it means to be a manufacturing worker today. I talked to a steel worker who was in his 60s, and he said, look, when I was hired, all I needed was a strong back. He had to go back in his 40s, 20 years ago, to learn a lot of math and some software stuff so now he could operate the kind of automated stuff in the steel mill in Ohio. And if you look at Europe, I mean, Germany in particular manufactures very high-value products. They pay their factory workers more, but they sell those products for more. Like, I'm thinking like a BMW, for example. And, the robots, the machines that make the machines quite often are made in Germany and Switzerland and Austria with very high-wage workforces, but they're very well-trained and they make these high-value products. So we really have to do a better job in providing skills for our young people.
Steve Phillips.
Might be where you could learn a little bit from Asia. You know, Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, China have an education system that in some ways is very unfair and that can be very difficult to get into college. On the other hand, its tracking system creates this system of technical schools at the high school level for people who have probably decided they're not going to college.
Mm-hmm.
And they can really focus their efforts. They, instead of treating it as in you didn't get into college, therefore you must do this, it's treated as a positive thing to go and do. I would argue the U.S. is kind of behind the Asian countries
like
in their system.
Yeah, that sounds like a smart model to me.
Yeah.
Steve Phillips, our China specialist, a couple of questions for you. China has a growing middle class.
Yes.
It's increasingly a consumer society. Is there any benefit in that to the United States in terms of our discussion in manufacturing?
I would just say every single year, we hope so.
Yeah.
And I'd be clear that since, in the 1800s, they used to say, if everybody in China would buy a shirt, the looms of Great Britain would run 24 hours a day.
Right.
So it is important to remember, we have this discussion all the time.
Yeah.
But China is only a $7,000 per capita income country. And so even what they define as a middle class is not what we define as a middle class. And it's been very difficult to sell U.S. goods there. And it's been very difficult for the U.S. to solve its merchandise trade deficit through China. And we probably won't be able to. It's in the services where the Americans, I think, feel they can have a bigger advantage, software and things like that. Their middle class just doesn't have as much money as what we define as the middle class. And China's aging.
Do you have a comment on where this trade agreement could lead us in terms of this, China and the U.S. relations?
Do you mean the TPP?
Yeah, the TPP.
China is excluded from it thus far, which is
right.
An amazing development.
Right.
It's sort of every important country in the region except China. And this may, in fact, reflect the fact that sometimes we sit here and we talk about the U.S. and its China problem with trade. Our China problem is minor compared to many countries and their China problem.
Well, it makes the whole world more competitive for China, no?
Yes.
I mean, specifically Asia, Vietnam, Cambodia, Bangladesh, for instance.
Low-wage manufacturers that would love to sell more to the U.S., but for a long time they haven't been able to compete with China.
Darius, do you have a comment about that proposed agreement?
Not really. I mean, again, it's an idea of trying to get a more competitive situation. Again, trying to take a little bit of control away from China in terms of those regions, which I think is very important. We've had numerous trade agreements going forward, but I think this definitely will, hopefully be a step in the right direction.
Nelson, what do you think?
economists will say, and it is correct, that generally, free trade benefits economies in the long run and is a good thing. I would agree with that. I would just add, though, there's another economic notion, creative destruction, and that while free trade ultimately is for the best, in the meantime, it can be pretty painful if you're on the destruction part rather than the creative part, and that I'm not saying NAFTA was a mistake. I'm just saying you have to be honest about everything cutting both ways, and NAFTA. Really, devastated a lot of industries that hung on in the South, like a lot of the textile stuff, where it was non-union. Maybe it had been in Maryland or New England in the 19th and early 20th, then it moved to the South, and then once with NAFTA, a lot of stuff left in the 90s. And again, ultimately, where we will succeed is value-added. That's all true, and we need to be globally competitive. But I think people should be honest that, while this would be good in terms of economic growth and trade, there will be losers as well as winners, and we as a society have to address that.
Nelson Schwartz, economics and economy reporter for the business section of the New York Times. Steve Phillips, history professor at Towson University with a specialty in China, and Darius Irani, chief economist with the Regional Economic and Studies Institute based at Towson. We add to the conversation conversation now, Teresa Fort, who is at the Tuck School of Economics at Dartmouth College, a professor there, who got her doctorate down here at the University of Maryland College Park a few years ago. And thank you for joining us, Teresa.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be with you.
Yeah, so I guess we ought to talk a little bit more about the lay of the land of manufacturing in the United States. I said at the outset of the show that some people might think this is an odd conversation. There isn't much manufacturing left in the United States. It's a small percentage of the total economy. Maybe you could describe that landscape for us a little bit in terms of what actually is made still in the United States, besides cars, which we know about.
Sure. Well, I think a lot of your guests have touched on some of this. It's definitely the case that employment in manufacturing has been going down in the U.S., but as they talked about, sales and value added has been going up even while we've seen those employment declines. So it's not that we're not making stuff, it's just that we are making stuff with fewer people.
And we're not making as many consumer goods as would be noticeable to the public.
Exactly. And so that's another topic that we've sort of you've sort of touched on already, which is just that the U.S. Is never going to be as competitive as China, let's say, in terms of wages. And so a lot of the very labor-intensive, lower-skill type of manufacturing jobs have moved overseas, and what you have left in the U.S. tends to be the higher-skill manufacturing. So, for example, there's a lot of companies that will have factories in Taiwan and in China and in other countries. They still might have some factories in the U.S., and that's where they produce the goods that are more complicated to make, that require greater technical expertise, potentially that have more intellectual property embedded in them, and they don't want to risk manufacturing that overseas where that intellectual property might be stolen. And then also, as one of your guests mentioned, time is becoming an important factor in goods. So the ability to get certain goods quickly to consumers and to be able to customize them also matters, and that's also a factor in keeping manufacturing more local and keeping it in the U.S.
Teresa, I didn't get a chance to ask you about the reshoring trend. I don't even know if we should call it a trend because it's not a big number yet. I mean, it is interesting to keep an eye on that. What do you make of it?
So I think I generally agree that we do have these interesting anecdotes, but we haven't documented in the data a big trend. Now, part of that is because it is actually very hard to measure where all of the different components are made. So as your guests are probably aware, or your listeners are probably aware, the global supply chains are getting more and more integrated. And so, for example, the iPhone ships into the U.S. from China, but China is actually doing a very small part of the total production of that phone, and some of it's getting done in Germany and some in Japan and some in Taiwan. And we just don't track very well in the international trade statistics where each component is made. And so it's hard to know where companies are making all of the different inputs into their final products that they sell. So it's hard to measure that, and there's lots of efforts underway to measure that. But I do think that as we see wages go up, we are seeing where things are made change. And as your guest said, it may not be that things are leaving China and coming back to the U.S. Certain products might be moving to an even lower cost location like Vietnam. Yep. But an interesting question going forward is going to be this ability to try to track what is coming back to the U.S. and how can we measure that better.
Steve Phillips?
Yeah, you know, the other problem is it China's economic growth or economic growth in China? When Apple makes a product there, it's a U.S. company making giant bucket loads of money, but it's a product from China.
Right.
I mean, the lines have gotten much more blurred over time. And I think that adds to some
of
the...
You're wondering how you measure that.
Right, because Apple makes a huge amount of money,
yeah,
but it is a product that employs a bunch of Chinese laborers working with a Taiwanese subcontractor with
right.
parts from Germany and Japan.
Although it's so what's interesting is somebody's actually done a study of the iPhone as an example, and so it shows how our current trade statistics, and for example, in particular, bilateral trade deficits, so our trade deficit with China, is overstated by a significant amount just because we don't record where each of the components of the value added are taking place, and instead we would attribute it all to China. So we would say we're importing a $200 iPhone from China, and let's say we weren't exporting anything to China, then that would be a $200 deficit with China. But in fact, it's really just a $2 deficit with China because almost all of the value of that iPhone is being made in other countries. So China is not always benefiting, and it's sometimes getting falsely labeled as the large current account deficit partner that we have, because it has been, traditionally, it has been kind of at the last stage of the value chain. Now, as China's wages are going up, China's skills, workers are improving their skills, that's actually changing. So we're seeing China move down the value chain so that it's actually not the last guy, not the assembler for a lot of products now. But we have to be very careful just in terms of what we can measure and the conclusions we draw from the limitations of our ability to track where each input is made.
Steve? Samsung, I think, is now making millions of phones in Vietnam. And I think that's a factory that I think might have come from China.
Right.
And that sort of shows how the world is changing.
One thing I want to just go over here before we take our next break with our guests who are in the studio with me, and Teresa Fort and Nelson Schwartz at the New York Times, if you want to add to this. One takeaway here is that I think people think of manufacturing jobs, the old blue-collar smokestack jobs, which we know are long gone. And you've all made excellent points here today. So someone looking at this who thinks, the answer to our chronic high unemployment, say, in inner city Baltimore, is we need manufacturing jobs. Well, the manufacturing jobs of the future aren't going to look like those of the past. So we get back to education, correct? This brings us back to the E word, education. And there doesn't seem to be any way around that. I'll go to Darius Irani for...
Yeah, no, I mean, there are some, you know, innovative things coming in manufacturing. Think about additive manufacturing. So, you know, it's a concept of building something with a printer, which is, you know, taking hold.
3D printer.
3D printing, which is something which is taking hold in many places for rapid prototyping, those type of things. You know, it's a little bit different from the traditional manufacturer. You may be able, because again, the way the structures are formed, you know, requires some engineering, but also requires some, you know, artistic ability to kind of make those things degrade. Maryland has its own little manufacturing 3D center out in Howard County, which sort of, you know, helps train some of the future workers. So there are some opportunities in low volume, high value manufactured goods, customizable, which I think was mentioned, that you can produce low quantity goods for consumers. You know, without having incurring a large startup cost, which typically has been the case when you make a pair of sneakers, those kind of things.
We're going to talk some more about 3D printing in the second hour of our show today. Teresa, do you have any sort of closing comments in terms of the future and someone thinking about a career in manufacturing? You got to get yourself to school.
Absolutely. I think we've touched on it a number of times in this conversation. Manufacturing in the U.S. has certainly changed. If you go to a manufacturing plant now, you're going to see very few workers and lots of machines. And those workers are going to know how to operate computer-aided design and computer-aided manufacturing software. So they are going to be much more skilled than somebody taking a cog and sticking it in a hole. And those skills are critical. And it's not necessarily a college degree. So I think we also talked about these technical skills. Germany is very good at it. Another country that's been very successful in Europe is Denmark. So they offer a lot of retraining programs for workers who get displaced, say, from a trade agreement. So certainly we want to think about how U.S. companies can be as competitive as possible in this global environment, and I think that is with trade liberalization. But as Nelson pointed out, there are going to be losers, and so it's kind of the government's job to think about how can we ensure that those workers who might lose out can acquire the skills necessary to work in the higher skill manufacturing jobs that are going to be the future for the U.S.
Teresa Fort from the Tuck School of Economics at Dartmouth College, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
And Steve?
You know, I think in the long run, maybe what we'll do is talk less about manufacturing and more about services, banking, entertainment, software, you know, things that the United States does very, very well at a very, very good price. And I sometimes feel the problem is we're so focused on breaking down manufacturing trade barriers with China when it's $600 versus $4,000 a month.
Right.
When the real thing is to get the protection of intellectual property rights, to get China to allow U.S. movies and TV shows to come in much more freely, to stop piracy of software. That's probably one way to help solve the trade deficit with China, rather than thinking we're going to do a lot of change the goods.
And Nelson Schwartz?
I would just add that you know, there's no reason why manufacturing couldn't provide great jobs for kids in Baltimore graduating from school who may not have other options right now. But I don't know what the Baltimore City schools have done in the last 20 or 30 years, but many, many school systems have moved away from vocational ed. And I think that's a really, really big mistake because, you know, we say you have to go to college, but what about the people who don't go to college? And, you know, Germany and now South Carolina is beginning to do this with German companies. They're doing, beginning very slowly, but some interesting experiments to do vocational training in high schools with kids learning in the classroom regular subjects, learning some vocational skills at the school, and then working a bit in the factories. And I think that's a great kind of model to sort of get kids on the sort of the track to where they could get some of these, you know, jobs that pay $15 to $25 an hour rather than $10 an hour at Walmart.
Mm-hmm. Nelson Schwartz, who writes for the business section of the New York Times. Thanks so much for being with us today, Nelson.
Always great. As a former Sun guy, yeah. always good to be on in Baltimore.
Yep, nice to have you on the show. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And also thanks Steve Phillips, a history professor at Towson University, for being with us. And Darius Zirani, chief economist at the Regional Economic and Studies Institute, also at Towson. Thank you, Darius.
Thank you.
We'll take a break here. When we come back, Under Armour. What about Under Armour? Could Under Armour make a profit making products in the United States? When we get back, we'll talk to Sam Poser, a market research analyst at Stern AG, about that. So stay with us. I wrote a column in the Sun, a couple of months ago, wondering whether Under Armour, based here in Baltimore, could produce some of its products here in the United States, put some Americans to work. UA, made in the USA. Is that such a thing possible? I invited Sam Poser back on the show with us because Sam's a great market research analyst of apparel and footwear, specifically for Stern AG. Sam, nice to have you back on the Midday Show.
Well, thanks for having me.
So let's just go over this again. Indulge me, would you, Sam? Could Under Armour make a profit making products in the United States?
If they can do something that has the value of the product itself, I just don't believe people buy stuff just because it's made in the United States, regardless of the company.
It's not a selling point as it used to. It doesn't have cachet anymore.
I mean, we're talking about value add.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, if there's a T-shirt for an Under Armour T-shirt for argument's sake that retails for $35-$40, and the margins are it can be as good a T-shirt as what you can buy made somewhere elsewhere, made here in the States, then when you say made in the USA and it's the same T-shirt and it's just as good and the price is the same, that would be something that people would say, oh, I'll buy the one made here. But if that T-shirt, to make a $30 T-shirt here, it ends up not being as good quality, or to have as good a T-shirt, you have to charge $60 for it. I don't think the consumer's going there just because it's made in the U.S.
Okay. So there's a couple of big ifs there. What about transportation costs, the costs of actually, you know, producing these products and bringing them over here? Does that figure into it at all? I know it figures in, but it's not critical, I guess. When you look at the cost of labor.
I mean, when you think about a T-shirt, on footwear, for instance, transportation can be, you know, on a boat, you know, 75 cents to a dollar. So, and it doesn't, you know, again, that can be a very high percentage of a less expensive product, but they don't make cheap stuff. I mean, and remember that if you're paying somebody whatever they pay in Asia, you know, a dollar. I mean, let's call it a dollar an hour. That's probably too much. And then all of a sudden you got to pay somebody $15 an hour here. Difference between, I mean, it just doesn't add up.
We get that. Okay, well then, Sam, it's interesting that we're talking just after the President Obama visited Nike out in Oregon just late last week, and we have Nike announcing that it would create some 10,000 manufacturing and engineering jobs in the U.S. if the Pacific Trade Agreement were approved. So I know you're aware of that news. So what do you make of that? There's Nike saying 10,000 possible jobs in the U.S.
Yeah, I mean, I think more of them are engineering jobs, and I think, you know, on the prior segment, you started talking about education. And I mean, I think the big problem we have, and this is more of a political statement we have, is that, you know, nobody has any patience. You want manufacturing jobs here tomorrow. The problem is that we have to come up with something great that we can manufacture, that we have a skill set that other people don't have. And we don't, and that all comes down to education from the very, you know, from kindergarten up. The problem is to get us where we need to get to with that, it's going to take 18 years. It's not going to happen tomorrow.
Right.
And nobody has any patience. You know, it's you know, people are elected every 4 years, so that's about as much patience as you possibly get. And this is a much bigger conversation than if somebody's going to make shoes or clothes or hats here in the States. It's a question of it's a much broader question than that. And it's going to take fortitude and patience to get there. But the manufacturing question is a result. It's not a thing by itself.
No, I get what you mean. It's the result of developing a more educated workforce, a creative society that comes up with ideas and, as you say, things that the world wants.
I mean, if you think about, you know, we were a more agrarian society back a long time ago, and everything's evolved, and nothing collapsed. You know, some things went away, and other things grew out of them. And you know, I think that, you know, we're not. I think as Americans, I think we've gotten caught in a situation where we've become very entitled to, you know, everything we want. Everything is there, but the fact of the matter is, we do have to work for some of these things, and it takes time. And I think that's something that's left out of the conversation all the time.
No, I think it's
and a lot of that is my own belief. There's no specific analysis going on.
Right. We also have gotten used to certain prices for products that are made overseas. So the idea of adjusting to prices based on what American workers would need to have, say, middle-class life and to be in manufacturing of consumer products. You know, your specialty is sports apparel and footwear or apparel and footwear. That's another thing. I don't know if the consumer society may think in the ideal, yeah, it would be great if this T-shirt were made in Baltimore or Cleveland, but what about the price? Americans have gone used to that price and have that expectation.
Without a doubt. That's absolutely true.
Yeah. All right, Sam. And the last thing is, are there any companies in the field that you watch, in the market that you watch, who talk at all about, you know, reshoring, bringing some work back to the United States?
Well, there's some. I mean, there's some companies that make certain things here, and given certain trends that have happened of late, that business has picked up, but it's premium product. I mean, New Balance is a good example of that. New Balance has always had some sneakers that have always been made in the United States. For years, they've had it. Mm-hmm. Of late, those shoes have become very popular because they're sort of retro fashion. So you're talking about these sneakers that retail for $170 to $240.
Right.
But the market for that is very specific,
mm-hmm.
and people again, and again, it's very specific. And part of the heritage of that product is it's made in the U.S., and it's a retro thing that is it's part of what that product has always been.
Right.
I don't see them going to new performance product made in the United States. So, there are certain people that are doing well with made in the U.S. product. But it's more from a more of a fashion perspective than we need to make more product in the United States.
In the United States. I get you, Sam. Hey, Sam, thanks for your time again.
My pleasure.
Yeah,
have a great one.
Yeah, nice to have you on the show. Sam Poser, market research analyst with Stern AG in New York City. More ahead on Midday in our second hour. We'll continue our conversation about manufacturing with a specific look at manufacturing in Maryland.